This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United. I'm Matt Ketchell, football editor at Chronicle Live, and our walk through the entire 140-year history of this fantastic football club has hit an extremely significant era. It's the late 1960s, and Newcastle United are about to enter a new frontier in spectacular fashion. European football is here. Last week's episode covered the return of Joe Harvey, a promotion back to the top flight, and a brush with European royalty when the club played European Cup holder Celtic over two legs that were friendlies, inverted commas. This episode will cover the period from 1968 to 1971, and joining me as ever is the club's official historian, Paul Joannou, and it's our absolute honour to welcome Newcastle United's Fairs Cup winning captain, Bob Moncur. Bob, a warm welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Bob, I want to start by reminding our listeners about your contribution to the club as a player during this era, the 60s and 70s. So Bob was one of the finest captains to ever lead out Newcastle United, a superb central defender who marshalled the Magpies to a European final and an FA Cup final. A likeable man off the pitch, rugged and determined player on it. Bob arrived in Newcastle as an attacking halfback or inside forward, but had to be patient for his break in the first team. That came in the 1965-66 season, when he found his feet as a central defender, a position he would dominate and make his own over the next eight seasons. Few were better in this role during this era, with Bob's ability to read the game setting him apart from the rest and prompting Sir Matt Busby, of all people, to say he is a splendid captain and a leader of men. Bob, we're doing this podcast to educate and remind supporters about the incredible history of Newcastle United, and you're a big part of that. I wanted to start by asking you a big question, and that is, what does Newcastle United mean to you?
Well, I think, Matt, the fact that I've been down, as you've said, I came down in 1960 as a young boy and had a problem getting in the first team initially after doing the apprenticeship thing, but eventually I did get in, and to be at Newcastle United all these years was just, obviously I went away and played. Dare I say, I went to play at Sunderland as well, but I thought that was a proper move for my career. And I went on to manage Carlisle as well. But eventually, the calling was at Newcastle United, and now I'm back there working as a club ambassador. And I think I have many, many... Now you've prompted me by saying, you know, we're going to have a little chit-chat. I've been thinking of all the bits and pieces, rereading Paul's book just to bring me up to... Gives me memory goes. So fantastic for me. And I just, I've been around the club through good, bad, indifferent. And I'm just happy to be involved at the football club at the minute.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. Can't wait to get into this and chat about this period with you. Paul, if you could set the scene then. At the end of the last episode, we touched upon the slightly fortuitous circumstances that paved the way for Newcastle's first entry into European football. It was all very new and exciting, wasn't it?
It certainly was. When qualification for the old Intercity Fairs Cup occurred, which is now roughly equivalent to the Europa League, that occurred in the summer of 68, and excitement soon reached a high point. Competitive European football was something completely new to United's fans and to the North East as a whole. European action at the time had caught on with firstly Celtic winning the European Cup, these days the Champions League, of course. That happened in 1967. Then Manchester United did likewise in 1968. And, Europe arrived in the Northeast. It was, for me, as a 14-year-old going on 15-year-old, just something completely caught my imagination. And of course, all the games were under the floodlights. And that made it even more atmospheric with a full house at St. James's Park. And at the time, I just couldn't wait for it to start.
Yeah, and Bob, European football was also new to most of United's players too, wasn't it? Not many had played European club football, although some did have international football experience. I wondered what the expectation was like when Newcastle made their Fairs Cup bow at home to Feyenoord, who were a top European side in September 1968.
Well, I think it's important, Matt, before that, to see, you know, it's Paul said we got in through the back door. At least we were told we got in through the back door. And quite frankly, we I think we finished 10th in the league. But of course, with the two city rule, one team, one city rule, we came into. And I actually knew about we had a chance of getting into Europe. However, I've got to tell you, I was out on holiday, and I got a phone call from John Gibson, saying that I think he is actually there at the draw. He says, "We're in Europe." I said, "Yeah, I know. I'm in Marbella." I had no realise, and even then, I didn't realise how important that was to me. I have to say, when I was away on holiday, I wasn't thinking about, are we going to be playing in Europe or are we not? It wasn't high on my priority list, but it was just a fantastic, and I think that's how it started. We started off thinking, well, we're in this cup, and I think everybody's attitude was, we just took it as it came. Certainly as players, I think the fans took it more, dare I say, seriously and more exciting than we did, because we just thought we got in through the back door a little bit, albeit I have to say we did walk out the front door with a cup, but that's another point. And I do think at the time it was just it's great, you know, what does that mean to us? And it's only when I came back to Newcastle and realised the fervour, if you like, of the fans and people talking about being in Europe. And, you know, I think I was 22 at the time, maybe. And I had no idea actually what it meant until, obviously, when we started playing, then it all became apparent.
Yes, and trust Gibbo to break the news to you, of course. John Gibson, legendary Chronicle writer, who we're going to have on the show in the next episode, actually. So, yeah, brilliant. Paul, if you could then talk us through that first round tie against Feyenoord and the rest of what would turn out to be a glorious run all the way to the final.
Yeah, well, against the Dutch, who were a very good side, had some excellent players. United actually got off to a wonderful start at St James's Park. They shocked everyone, everyone in Europe as well, with a 4-0 victory. And it was a wet Gallagher surface with a big crowd, around about 46,000, I think. And it was local winger, a youngster called Jeff Allen, who broke into the side. He had a field day on that night. Absolutely remember him skipping down the wing on the popular side in the first half and tearing the Dutch defenders apart. And United eventually won 4-0. They could have got more goals, to be honest. And that was the start of a run to the final, which was just brilliant. And the crowds grew after that and was more or less a full house in every game. The second round, we played Sporting Lisbon, another very good top European side. And that saw a wonderful Pop Robson volley from a free kick at St James's Park. And there was 53,000 at that game. And then we played Real Zaragoza. These days, not a great Spanish club, but back in 1968-69, there were a decent Spanish team. And that saw another Robson gem at St James's Park, this time a 30-yarder. And the crowd was 56,000 at St James's Park then. So the supporters had, you know, gradually, game after game, caught the imagination of what was happening on Tyneside. And in the quarterfinal, we played a virtual unknown, Vitória Setúbal of Portugal. And Newcastle were a bit lucky, I suppose, because it snowed that night at St James's Park, and nearly all of the Portuguese, I should say, had hardly seen snow before, and 57,000, so Newcastle win 5-1. And they needed those five goals, because in the second leg in Portugal, they gave Bob and Co a bit of a roasting. So, you know, it was an exciting run up to the quarterfinal.
Yeah, and there was an interesting semi-final tie. But before we talk about that, Bob, any memories of that little run up to the semi-final?
Loads of memories, Matt. Just let me go back to the very beginning. It's worth mentioning that when we played Feyenoord, I wasn't playing, because we played in a pre-season friendly up at Hibs. And the things I remember about playing then, it was a red-hot afternoon in the summer. And I was playing back in Edinburgh, of course, and that's where, you know, my mum and dad just lived outside Edinburgh. And my mother, for the first time, came to a match, and I got carried off with a cartilage problem. And I didn't obviously play for against Feyenoord. And unlike today, I think I was skipper of the club by that time, but unlike today, I wasn't due to go to Feyenoord. I was left out of the whole squad. And eventually I got there, but I went with the supporters on their plane, which I paid for, to go over there with the supporters to to watch my team play against Feyenoord over there. It's amazing what you think back. And to be fair to Joe Harvey, who was like a god to me, his strategy, which I can talk about a little bit later, it was somewhat surprising, because when somebody said, "And why is the skipper not going?" He said, "Well, he's no good. He can't play, so he's not going." And that was as simple as that. And I didn't ask any questions. And I watched the first leg from the paddock, which used to be the paddock. I was actually in the paddock. I don't know why I was in the paddock. I wasn't in the stand. And I watched it. I might be with my dad. I was in the paddock watching the game. And then the leg away, I went with the supporters. They invited me. I'm trying to think of the guy's name, Peter, who was the commercial director, whatever you want to call him. I went with the supporters there and back. And I look back now and thinking, that wouldn't have probably happened nowadays, but that's the way the game was. And Joe was absolutely fantastic mentor for me, and as he was for the rest of the players. And I think he's worth a big, big mention in the FAIRS Cup run.
Yes, absolutely. We'll definitely talk about Joe, and that's amazing to hear that. Didn't know that, Bob. That's why you're here, to give us that fantastic well, insight. So the semi-final, Newcastle reached against the odds and met Glasgow Rangers at home and away. Obviously, it was two legs in May 1969. Now, even though this was many years ago, I'm very aware of this infamous game. But Paul, if you want to first remind us how the two legs played out, please.
Well, it was a big tie, of course. Rangers, as they are now, a huge club in Scotland and in Europe at the time. And of course, there was a big crowd at Ibrox, 75,000, which was, apart from cup finals at that point, the biggest crowd that Newcastle had played in front of. And it was a 0-0 draw. And the hero that night was Willie McFall, the goalkeeper, who saved an Andy Penman penalty. And that was crucial. It kept the tie very much alive for the return leg, and 59,000 were on Tyneside as United raced to a 2-0 advantage, and then only to witness a Scottish invasion of the pitch. There were thousands of Rangers fans on Tyneside and in Gallagher that night, and the players had to be taken off for over 15 minutes. They invaded the pitch from the Gallagher end. I was in the centre paddock and was just praying that the Glaswegians, who had far, far too much to drink, wouldn't come anywhere near me, that's for certain. And to be honest, a full-scale sort of fight and riot was averted only because the Newcastle fans more or less stayed in their end of the ground at the Leasers end and didn't join in on the pitch. But eventually it was all put back into control, and Newcastle ran out 2-0 winners.
Mm. Bob, dying to hear what your memories of that night was.
Well, I've got many memories of that, bearing in mind I'm a Scotsman and I know what the Scotsmen are like. But in all fairness to the Rangers and the Rangers supporters, it was made out maybe to be worse than what it actually was. Because as I can remember, what caused it was at the Gallagher end, that's where all the Rangers supporters were housed. That was their bit. And what happened was, I think, when we were 2-0 up, the Rangers supporters started to throw bottles from the back of the Gallagher. And what was happening, it was actually hitting their own supporters who were down near the front, and they took cover. And what did they do? They obviously spilled on the pitch. And I think that's what really started it. It spilled on the pitch. And then once they got on the pitch, of course, they started to run. And it, Paul says, the Newcastle United fans was more singing something like, "We're staying here, we're staying here," which I think averted a fairly major incident, if you like, because I think if the Newcastle supporters had came on from the Leeds end, it would have been World War III. So, in theory, it was the Rangers supporters' fault, but I think that was the reason why some of the players came on the pitch. It just some of the players, the spectators, because they were getting hit by their own players, by their own supporters throwing bottles onto the Gallagher end. But the one thing I remember about it when I realised what was happening, I remember playing on the left-hand side, and we're kicking towards the Leeds end, and I was playing away, and I'm sure I saw something flash over the left side of me into the paddock, the left-hand side paddock. And I thought, I wonder what that was. And then you're playing on because the game's still live, and the next thing I know, Willie McFall runs past me on the right-hand side, taps me on the shoulder and says, "Run." And by the time he had said run, he was away in front of me. So I went, "What?" Turned around, and I saw this invasion coming. So would you believe I actually beat him down the tunnel? And I think that was, it was okay, as Paul says, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it was, we had to go off, but the game had to be finished, of course, that's the law. And I remember, and it was all a bit bad for Rangers. You know, I liked Rangers. It was bad publicity for them. But in fairness to the directors of Rangers Football Club, I think when we went off, I think it was decided by the Rangers officials, the chairman, I think his name now, Paul, he went to the referee and said, you know, we would like to, more or less, we'll concede this game. Even though there was 20 minutes to play, he actually said, we need to concede this game because of what's happened. But unfortunately, we had to go, because of the rules, we had to go back on and finish the game. And we went back on, finished the game, no incident at all, it was fine. I think most of the Rangers supporters had left by then. And then I was invited into the, normally after the game in the Fairs Cup, you would go, all the players would get a present from the opposition team. And that was normally done at a little sort of function after the match. But on this occasion, I was asked to go up to the chairman's, the boardroom at Newcastle United, which was upstairs in them days. I had to go up to the boardroom, and I've got to tell you, that was the first time I'd ever been in the boardroom. I thought I was out when I was an apprentice, but I'd never actually been there officially. And the chairman of the Rangers Football Club said to me, we'd just like to make this little presentation for you now rather than do it publicly, and apologised very, 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 very. He was very, very sad about what happened to Rangers that night. And I remember, I think at the time, he didn't look too well. I'm desperately trying to think of his name. Paul, can you remember his name, the chairman of Rangers Football Club?
I can't, no, sorry.
Anyway, the reason he didn't come down to do it officially in the dressing room or whatever in function, because he wasn't up to it. And I remember thinking, that's hit Rangers very, very hard. And I thought, because of the incident, yes, it looked terrible, but in fairness, as I say, it was instigated by their own supporters throwing bottles at their own, because they couldn't throw them far enough, and they'll get hit in the back of the head. Now I know if I was standing at the gallery and just behind the nets, I would have got on the pitch as well, because I didn't want to get hit with bottles. So it was a big thing was made of it, but how it started wasn't as bad as you might think it was.
And just to add that these were real bottles, glass bottles, not plastic bottles you get today. They were good old-fashioned Newcastle Brown Ale bottles.
Well, I've got to say, Paul, the next day in the Chronicle, there was a picture of the Gallagher end. It's a fantastic picture. It just shows you the goalposts and then the Gallagher end, and you couldn't see for bottles and cans. Unbelievable. They're all just lying on the terrace. You must have that picture somewhere, Paul. Brilliant. Yeah. All it was just, what about this then? And hundreds and hundreds of cans and bottles. I can still see that in my mind.
We'll dig that image out. And was it John Lawrence, the name of the chairman at Rangers?
Could well have been. Well done. Well done, Matt. Mm-hmm. Did you well do done. A quick research there, did you?
Well done, Google. Well done, Google. Yeah. Amazing night then for many different reasons. And it took Newcastle to the first major European final, the first time of asking to face Hungarian side. I'm going to leave the pronunciation of that side to you, Paul. It was played over two legs, the first of St James's Park on the 29th of May, and the second leg in Hungary was a full 12 days later on Joe Harvey's 51st birthday, no less, Paul.
Yes, that's right. My Geordie pronunciation is Uch Pesti Doza. sometimes with an I, sometimes without an I. Bob, you might know the proper pronunciation. But at the time, they were one of Europe's best sides with several well-known players, including a very famous forward called Ferenc Benny. At St James's Park, the first leg, it was a full house, 59,000, although 60,000 tickets were sold. I don't know where the other 1,000 went. But they saw United 3-0 up on an early summer evening in June. At the end of May, a certain Bob Moncur hit the net twice on that day. And in the second leg, of course, he scored again as United came back from 2-0 down to win handsomely 3-2 in Budapest.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Bob, you couldn't have even dreamt about what was to happen to you personally in that final. You were never a goal scorer, although you did grab one in the FA Youth Cup final in 1962. But a hat-trick across two legs in a European final. You mentioned Joe Harvey. He ignored you when you were injured. What was his reaction like at the full-time whistle of that one?
Well, I think everybody was celebrating. I can't remember all the details, but it was obviously it was a big surprise, I think, because I call the team Ujupest Dosha. That's my Scottish pronunciation, right or wrong. I've got to also just tell you something else who used to call them. Big Jack Charlton, sadly no longer with us. He used to call them Upsy Daisy. That was his Big Jack Upsy Daisy. Anyway, they were a great side because they had beat Leeds, I think, and they were supposed That's to right. be one of the best sides in Europe. I think it was either Don Revy or Jock Stein had said these are one of the best teams in Europe. So we were up against a good side. And to be fair, I think it was it 0-0 at half time, Paul?
I think it was, yes. And yeah, they went pretty close in that first half.
And there was like 60,000 people there, and it was give and take. It was touch and go, and they had I think they had about six or seven Hungarian internationals who were top players at the time. And so it was difficult for us, but we defended well and we worked hard. And of course, we always had the winning pop and with two wingers and Jackie Sinclair and Scotty who could cross the ball and two great midfield players in Tommy Gibb and Benny Arntoft and myself at the back along with Clarkey and Craigie. And I think it was Ollie Button who was playing centre half that time. So we had a pretty good regular team, great team spirit. I have to say it probably wasn't the greatest talented team in the world. But the thing about it was we had a great team spirit. And, we just battled away thinking, because we weren't fair, they were favourites. And we just battled away and battled away. And I think we got a free kicker was lobbed in by Tommy Gibb. Wynne Davis, who was magnificent. You're too young to remember him, but he used to hang forever. And he pulled this ball in, hit the keeper, and came out, and fortunately landed at my feet. And I just... And I wasn't normally in there, but Joe Harvey wouldn't allow me to go over the halfway line unless it was set pieces, because I was supposed to be the one that organised the back. So that was my role. Don't you go over the halfway line. And whoever did, he used to start. I'm not telling you what he said if I did, but he was there with his cigarette back. So on this occasion, because it was a dead ball situation, I think it was a corner, I can't remember, and I was up there, head up, boom, came my left foot, pinged it in. Did I aim for it? Not really. I just hit it as hard as I could. Fortunately, went to bat the net, and lo and behold, 10, 15 minutes later, I remember taking a ball on my chest, an hour half, on my chest, not very well controlled because it went bounced about 4 or 5 yards, but I kept after it, and then I started running, looking what was I going to do with this ball because I'm not used to being in their half, and then I saw it was Jimmy Scott, and I said, I'll give it to him, and for some... I passed it to him, 10, 15-yard pass ball, was it? Kind of, and I thought, I'll just keep running. And the next thing I knew, it was back at my feet. And then by that time, I was just on the edge of the box or inside the box. And I thought, well, again, I'll just hit it. And that's all I did. And that was it. That was the history of the two goals. And I remember coming back to Frank Clark. He was the first to congratulate me. And he said, you lucky so-and-so, so-and-so. He says, I've hit the target more times than you all these years, and yet you've scored. I said, well, it's about accuracy, Frank. And it was fantastic just to do that. And then that was the second goal. But over there, we were really under the collar because, like I said, they were a great side. Had some great players, internationals. And Joe was, of course, I've told the story many, many times. I'll tell it again if you wish. Joe, we're in before the game over there, right? And it was red hot. It was really... A bammy night, red hot, and we're not used to playing because it was, as Paul says, well into May, wasn't it?
Yeah, the second leg would be in June, I think.
That's right, it was in June.
So cricket weather, really.
We should have been on holiday, but we're helping to play football. So, and we're 3-0 up, remember, and of course, all the Geordie Nation expects us because we were good defensively, didn't lose many goals, they expect us to win the Cup. However, after about 30 minutes, things were a bit iffy, to say the least. And I remember it was going to be a difficult night because when we decide who's over there, unlike today, you toss a coin before the game starts. The referee comes in and the two captains, toss a coin to see who's going to go out on the pitch and warm up first. That was the protocol. One team went out, warmed up, their team came in and the other team went out. So I won a toss and I thought, well, we'll go out first. And I remember going out onto the pitch and running about, as you normally do, a little sprint here, pinging the ball there and all this. And the sweat was pouring down us. I kid you not, it was like so humid. After about 5 minutes or less than that, I said to the lads, never mind getting warmed up, I'm sweating, let's get back in and, you know, keep our energy for the game. And I walked in with a team, and Joe Harvey was in the dressing room, there in the dressing room with his fag lit in the dressing room. But that's the way it was in them days. And he said, what are you doing? I says, and he was obviously being, what are you doing, bringing the lads back in? I said, Gaffer, it's too hot out there. I've taken the decision. No point in running around there because we're warm enough anyway. I've brought the lads in. So on that note, he went, oh, right. And he walked out the doors, and he went out on the pitch. He came back 2 minutes later, and his classic leg, I can see him now. He came back and he went, bah. I can't tell you exactly what he said, but I can tell you, well, because I don't want to swear. But it was to the effect, goodness gracious, we've got a bit of a job on here tonight. And he says, good luck. And he walked out. Then that was his team talk before the game. So we went out, and sure enough, he was right. We got hammered. And it was only a good save by Willie. Bit of luck hit the post. They actually hammered us. And anyway, we came in half-time, 2-0 down, and devastated. You know, because we were a good defence. We were a good defensive team. A big one up the front as well with Pop, and that was always a get-out. And anyway, we came in, into the dressing room at half-time, and I mean, the sweat was pouring off me. And I remember sitting next to Frank, vice captain at the time, and my head was down. Joe wasn't in the dressing room. My head was down, and there was pools of sweat forming between my feet. That's how hot it was, just dripping off me. And we're sitting there. You can imagine the dressing room is silent. What we're going to do now, there's no sign of Joe. So we're all looking at each other, thinking. And I remember saying to Frank, did we ever need the boss? Now is the time. And at that, he walked in through the doors. And they were like, I always remember, like, swing doors. You're too old to remember. Man, John Wayne, you know, used to go in the saloon. There used to be these swing doors, didn't it? Where there was similar door, and he barred through this door, cigarette in hand, looks around the dressing room. We're all like heads down, fighting to look up. And he says, what's the problem? And I kept my head down. What's the problem? And he said it once, twice, three times. And eventually I stuck my head up. I said, well, I don't know if you've noticed, boss, but we're getting absolutely hammered. They're doing, you know, they're destroying us there. We can't get any control of the game. I says, that's the problem. And all the lads were sort of got started. And then Joe says, there is no problem. At that stage, I went, what? I can't remember what it was, but it was something like, are you kidding? No problem. We can't get a kick of the ball. And then Joe says, there's no problem. And so we waited for, how do you mean? And his famous quote was, all you've got to do in the second half is to go out there and score a goal. And at that, I couldn't resist myself. Score a goal. We've never been over the halfway line. Are you nuts? Well, what's that effect? And he just said, that's all you've got to do. He did use a few swear words, I've got to say. All you've got to do is go out there and score a goal, and these foreigners will collapse like a pack of cards. Or what's that effect? And he walked out. That was it. Off he went, left us. And we then started in Dave Smith, and we're talking crack. We're trying to get organised. But he'd gone. He just left us. So out we go. Of course, a minute into the second half, I think it was, ball comes in from Jackie Sinclair. Wynn heads it, but it went back to Jackie, knocks it back into me, and I was sort of on the edge of the box. And Jackie put a cross in. It was a little bit behind me, but I just swung and I volleyed it from just over the side, and it shot into the back of the net. I got it, you know, it was like hitting a perfect drive on a golf course. It just zoomed into the net. And there's somebody on the line tried to stop it, but it just knocked him down with his hands, bang. And from then on, of course, they fell apart. And then Alan Foggan or Benny Antoff both scored goals as well. And we actually beat them on the night 3-2. And the classic, going on to that, fantastic, do the celebration, get the cup. And we're going to the dressing room after it. Some of the directors were there. The press boys, I think, were there as well, because that's what used to happen in these. We're all just one team. But no Joe Harvey. And eventually we're drinking champagne. All of a sudden the door busts open again and Joe walks in, cigarette. He goes, what did I tell you? I can't see what he said before that, but he said, what did he well tell you? And he just laughed. And that was, now to me, that was a brilliant bit of management. Was he serious at the time or is he just lucky? We'll never know the answer, but that was Joe Harvey at his best.
It's amazing from Joe Harvey that he's just simplified it, hasn't he? Calmed you all down.
To be fair, Matt, he's looking at it, we're 2-0 down, getting stuffed. What's he going to say? He's not going to come up with any tactical genius, but if you stop doing that. It was all about team spirit and effort. And of course, and when we went over, after the 50 years celebration, we went over to see the team we beat, and it was great. They looked after us very, very well. And we went over there, and then we found out that when we scored that goal, the first goal in the second half, they all said that destroyed them. They're just like a knife in the stomach, and it just killed them off. Because and then, of course, I think Benny got another one very quickly, and Foggan scored a great goal, which I think to this day, if George Best had it, then it would have been goal of the year. But you never get a lot of credit for that. But it was just a great night. And then after that, can you believe, we obviously won a cup. We do a lap of honour around it. And it was about, I read somewhere 200-odd Newcastle supporters there, because it was very difficult to get to Hungary in them days. You have to have visas and all sorts of things. And anyway, we went round, and I remember running round with a cup in my hand, and somebody else got a cup, and somebody jumped on my back. And I went, you know, running around the track, I went, get off. It was my wife, Camille. She had come on the pitch. So that was a great night. And we obviously celebrated long into the night. Many, many stories I could tell you about some of the old press boys, Bob Cass, John Gibson, absolutely fantastic. We had there's a guy called Bob Cass who used to work for your company. Bob was a great character. And we went back, and Lord Westwood, Scotsman, bit tight, I've got to say, but he said to me, he says, right, Bob, I want you to take all the boys into such and such a room. And he says, I want you to give them a good time and organize some champagne. He says, but not the French champagne. Make sure it's the local stuff. And the press boys were part of the team as well. There's some great pictures, a great picture of all the press boys and Joe Harvey and myself. I might have been on the picture, on the River Danube. They were all there because they were all part of it. They from the day one, they were part of the group. And we went back and we had a sing-song in the hotel. And then the night just went on. Next morning, up to catch the plane early. A lot of sore heads, I can tell you.
So there we are, listener. Part one of our special two-part episode with Bob Moncur is done. The 18th instalment of Chronicled, the history of Newcastle United. It was a real treat to listen to the captain of the 1969 Fairs Cup winning side reflect on this era and that famous campaign. And we have even more from Bob for you next week when he discusses the homecoming, including an incredible anecdote from the open-top bus journey back to St James's Park. Bob also talks about Pop Robson, Malcolm MacDonald, and we'll have Paul Joannou with us to bring us up to date with the domestic fortunes of the club right through to 1971. Thanks everyone for listening. If you have any NUFC history stories, observations, facts, stats, memorabilia, you name it, you know where we are, the EIBW podcast at reachplc.com, or you can tweet me at Ketchell on Twitter. Please subscribe to the Everything is Black and White podcast via whichever podcast platform you're listening to. Follow Chronicle Live's Newcastle United Instagram channel at Chronicle NUFC, and we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Chronicle NUFC. If you're enjoying what we're doing with our history series, a nice 5-star review on iTunes would be fantastic if you have the time. And lastly, stay up to date with everything Black and White by subscribing to our daily Newcastle United newsletters. These are free, and a link to sign up to these is in the show notes. So hit that, scroll down to Sport, Newcastle United Updates, tick the box, and you'll be signed up. Thanks so much for listening to Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United, with me, Matt Ketchell, Paul Joannou, and our very special guest, Bob Moncur.